So, the first thing, my first responsibility here this morning is to recognize my co-author, Akeem Doberman. He's the one that really should be making this presentation, and so there's a lot of Akeem in the remarks that you're going to be hearing here today. Now, I recognize fully that you've got this question before you, more genes or more agronomists, and guess what? Two agronomists are asking the question. And so I'm sure it's a great mystery as to what how we're going to answer that question, but we'll just hold that off till towards the end of the presentation. What I would like to do here with you is take you through a couple of cases. We'll look at maize production in the U.S., and then we're going to go to southern Brazil. We'll look at rice production there, and we'll try to pull out some commonality with these two cases that seem to say convey a certain message. And before I get to the other aspects of maize, let me just go back and indicate that there is a bit of skepticism, perhaps, on the part of both Akeem and myself, relative to the claims of the impact of biotechnology on maize in the future. And all we're trying to say here is that this isn't going to be, in our mind, singular kinds of events. They may contribute, but there's much more involved that will be required to actually get to a 300 bushel per acre or 19 ton average yield in the U.S. by 2030, or to make these jumps over time that will add to substantial increases in infield water use efficiency. Contributions will be made, but the challenge is large, and our concern is that if we don't recognize that, there's a potential lead to undervaluing of those other factors in research support and in the whole system. Now, here's my version of this graph. I think this is probably the fourth time you've seen yield trends of maize in the U.S. This one happens to go from 1966 up through 2010 with the most recent USDA projection of 2010 yields. And the way Akeem and I look at this graph, we see, and I know others see other things, but we see a straight line, as linear as it can be, generating about 118 kilograms of yield per hectare. And you can look at 1970, you can look at 2005, it doesn't look to us like that slope has changed. Now, what our moderator did for us all a few years ago that really struck me is he reminded us of all that has taken place during that period of time in addition to some genetic changes. And you look back through all of those boxes on that graph, and you see almost every aspect of the system being touched, from the machinery and the equipment side of things to the pest management side to the plant nutrition. It's all been part of this package. And what amazes me is after all that comes through, we get a straight line. And that tells us that it has been a challenge just to maintain that straight line. And then as we look to the future and expect projections into an exponential growth, that is an incredible challenge. And it's going to take all aspects of the system to even think about getting to that point. Now, as we improved yields, there are some other things that happened that were very positive. And one of those has to do with nitrogen use efficiency. This happens to be partial factor productivity for nitrogen use in corn, kilograms of corn per kilogram of fertilizer in applied, and you see some striking increases since we bottomed out there in the early 70s. But that said, when we look in the field today, what we see is about a 50% recovery and often less than that. And so the point there is we have room to grow in efficiency. And you might ask the question of where is that efficiency gain going to come from? Will it be genetic? Will it be soil related? Will it be in the system? There may be some genetic contributions, but I guess as a soil scientist, I see a lot of low-hanging fruit yet in how we manage nitrogen and how we predict nitrogen release from soil and how we do a better job of managing the nutrient. And then if we can get some help genetically, that's great. But we've got a lot of work to do yet in how we manage nitrogen in that system. I'm going to skip that in the interest of time. Let's go to a study that has just recently been published. that really helps us address this question of how close we are in the farm, on the farm, to yield potential with some of our best farmers. This happens to be a very nice set of data that focuses on a three-county area in south-central Nebraska. Right there are the counties that we're looking at. We blow those up here, and they make a part of a natural resource district. And in Nebraska, like it or not, there are many things that are mandated. And one of the niceties of that is that these districts do generate a significant amount of data about how the crop is grown. And what the researchers did here was take that data and then supplement it through some surveys, and so you end up looking at 521 data points across these three counties. That's a pretty intensive evaluation of what's going on in those counties, and then they supplemented that with some survey information and did some statistics to find out that the supplemental subset did represent the whole population rather well. And so we go from there, and just some generalities about this study. First, the average from 01 to 08 was 12.1 tons per hectare in yield. That's the three-county average, so this is pretty productive maize we're looking at. And then we are eventually going to compare current actual yields to yield potential, and the yield potential was predicted here using a crop simulation model called Hybrid Maize that was developed by UNL people, where the model makes the assumption that nutrients and pests are not limiting. All right, and we can go into it a lot further, but that's basically, those are a couple of important observations relative to how we use this model. Now, there's a lot of things to talk about in this study, but we're going to focus in on just one graph that was published in the paper. And what it shows us is the actual yields averaged across these farms with time versus the simulated average yield from the crop simulation model, and then the simulated maximum yield from that model, where we have optimized relative maturity, population, and sowing date. Now, if we look a little closer at those actual yields and the trend that's there, what do you notice? Those last 8 years look awfully flat. And in fact, the slope across those is not significant. And they represent about a 21% difference between the mean of those years and the predicted yield potential. Now, that isn't a singular event. We've seen that show up in many data sets around the world on many different crops. You get within about 20%, maybe 15% of yield potential, and things start slowing down markedly. And that's exactly what appears to happen here. And why does that occur? It occurs for a number of reasons, a lot of them dealing with how producers deal with risk and risk management. It has to do with the risk of frost before physiologic maturity, harvest problems because of weather issues as you get into the season and soil conditions, harvest costs, so there's economic factors that come into it, lodging, a green snap, etc. There are a lot of reasons farmers aren't right there at yield potential. And there are the logistical challenges, of course, of just being a farmer and getting everything done. Now, the researchers conclude this paper with, I think, a very important statement, where they say that they see limited potential for further increases in irrigated maize yields without a substantial increase in the current yield potential ceiling, and suggest that that's going to come through, I like the terminology, brute force breeding, and agronomic research to exploit interactions. And that's something that I've been interested and fascinated with for many years, especially variety by nutrient interactions. We got into those back during the Green Revolution 3.1, if I learned right this morning, right, when we went to semi-dwarf cereals. We're working with those in South Dakota, and we saw how different their responses were to the standard varieties, and we all know that. Here's an old classic example that looks at year of hybrid release versus plant population, and simply shows that if you don't increase the population, those newer hybrids simply don't put out. And so it's an interaction, a very simple interaction. They get a lot more complex. You can have three-way, four-way interactions. I had a statement at the bottom here. Basically, says what I just indicated, that those interactions can be very important and not always easy to master. Okay, so let's make some observations about maize, and then we'll get on into the rice example. First, continuous yield and efficiency improvement appear associated with both genetic and agronomic changes. Secondly, none of the genetic interventions appear to have increased yield potential of maize. We're approaching that ceiling. Instead, they've come from reduced yield gaps and the enablement of better management. Agronomic factors interact in complex ways, but when you look at how close those farmers, those good farmers in those three counties in Nebraska were to yield potential, I mean, they've done a pretty good job of sorting through that and figuring out, in some cases intuitively and just being good observers, they've put some things together in a pretty effective package. And then the issue of approaching a yield potential ceiling in many of these very productive maize systems. So on to rice in southern Brazil. We'll see if some of these same things show up. Now, when we are in the U.S. talking about Brazil, usually you end up talking about the Cerrado. Well, that's not what we're going to do here. We're going to take you to the very far southern state in Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul, a major rice-producing area, and we're going to look at just some absolutely fascinating developments that have occurred down there. And they are illustrated in part by this graph. What you see here is a little over 1 million hectares of rice, and you see a red line there that shows a rather striking increase in grain yield. This is the yield axis over here with the red line. You're basically adding 2 tons of yield. And remember, now this is over 1 million hectares. Over 2 tons per hectare over a, what, 6-8 year period. And so if you're thinking about that at all, you're asking, how did that happen? What caused that to occur? And that's the story we want to tell here. And we're going to start the story through the eyes of Peter Jennings, who was the first rice breeder for Erie. IR-8 was mentioned earlier. As I understand it, this was pretty much the IR-8 inventor in many respects. And after a little later in his career, he kind of stopped functioning very much as a breeder and became an agronomist working in Latin America. And this is how he describes what happened there. He says, we go back here to the Green Revolution 3.1, and we have the impact of the semi-dwarfs being introduced, about a 2-ton yield enhancement, and then we're up here at this plateau that occurred in the late 60s, early 70s, and we just stayed there. That's at about 5 to 6 tons of rice yield per hectare. And Peter points out that 350 semi-dwarf varieties were introduced and nothing much happened. And so we got to the point where we asked, well, why? What is going on? Why are we not making progress in the field where it counts? And he says it was what was lacking was an agronomic revolution that he defined as inserting a package of practices, not one at a time, but as a package, as a complete set that had specific objectives and were implemented, as indicated, simultaneously, not one at a time. And then now he also continues this as he looks to the future. He feels that we're maybe approaching another ceiling where another varietal intervention of some sort is going to have to take place. We're going to have to move up to another yield level. So how did this happen? Well, an organization called FLAR, Latin American Fund for Irrigated Rice, was a big part of it. This operates across Latin America in 19 different countries. And I won't get into the details of it, but this was a key factor in getting a lot of people talking to each other, working together across national boundaries. Now, one of the keys to this whole process of change was recognizing that small details make big differences. And anybody that works in agronomy fully recognizes this. And this group recognized 6 strategic practices that were not site-specific. In other words, every site you had to address the 6 things that you see here. And as you look down through that list, excuse me, there isn't an individual item in there that gets very exciting to me, right? I mean, this is just basic stuff. I mean, this is simply, there's nothing very exciting there until you put the whole package together and see what happens. And until you get to a point where you get down to an individual level, and here we're talking about Rio Grande do Sul now, and then you start looking at specific aspects that are actionable kinds of descriptions of these practices where a farmer reads that and say, okay, I know what to do. And then you put the practice together, and that is basically what happened here. Now, in Rio Grande do Sul, this group, IRGA, was instrumental in getting these practices implemented. It's a group of agronomists with technicians and others, and they worked collectively with about 9,000 farmers, again, over a million hectares. This is one of the farmers that they worked with that was very successful, and standing next to him is his daughter, who just got back from getting a soil science degree and is now working as the chief agronomist in this large farm. And Akeem asked me to make sure that I emphasize how important young people and young agronomists were in this whole setting. They're part of the energy and the enthusiasm that it took to get these changes made and to move on to a new level of productivity and a new level of success. Now here we get down to an actual farm level. The practices before and the practices after this agronomic revolution at this farm level. And again, you look through these and there's nothing profound. There are no magic bullets. It's just the package. It's the whole package, getting the package right at one spot there on the earth. And so we're back to the yield levels and the dramatic increases that occurred over this last 8-year period. Looking at the frequency distribution of those yield levels, what an amazing picture this is. You had 60% of the yields below 6 tons in 2000, and then look at that distribution in 2008. Truly remarkable when you consider the number of hectares that are involved there. And as that was occurring, cost of production went down. Water use efficiency went up. Cut water use per unit of rice in half, and as they look to the future, this group thinks that they can cut it in half again. So key elements of success, systematic approach, not just product-centric, but putting all the products together into a package, agronomic principles that are actionable, large-scale technology, focused on farmer-to-farmer extension, and I'm running out of time, so I'm trying to talk really fast. All right, and this, let me back up just for a minute there. One of the key ingredients here was farmer involvement all the way through the process. A very critical involvement and teamwork where you had farmers interacting with others. And we've got a project we call Global Maize that really looks at identifying yield gaps, demonstrating them, and then determining what practices are necessary to try to close the gap faster than the common trajectory. And we've recognized also the importance of this teamwork concept. And in Brazil, we are very dependent upon two farmer foundations, the Mato Grosso Foundation and the ABC Foundation, and working in creating linkages across the sectors within the country and then also between countries. And what we find is that these people are truly enthusiastic to recognize this and participate in this, in Friedman's terminology, this flat world of agronomy. They love being connected to somebody in the U.S., somebody in China, somebody in Argentina that's all working on the same kinds of issues. Maybe they get to a different practice, but they're working on the same problems, and that adds to the synergism of the whole thing. So what we're talking about here is adaptive research linked to adaptive management. And we can take a schematic look at what that means, what adaptive management is, and I think you've all probably been through this before. You recognize a bunch of factors at a site that feed into some sort of a decision support mechanism, take stakeholder inputs, it generates an output for practice product variety rate, just like we saw in Rio Grande do Sul. A decision gets made, an action takes place, an outcome is generated, and the outcome is relative to productivity, profitability, environmental impact. That provides feedback into the starting point, tweaks the system, and the next time it spins through the loop, it gets just a little bit better. Adaptive research then feeds into that cycle, and the diagram has a definite mistake in it. Tell me what the mistake is. That arrow is going one way, and that is a mistake we have made for many, many years. That arrow needs to go both ways, and in fact, it does go both ways. And this diagram that was published by John Pesura from CSIRO, I think, does a beautiful job of showing this. And where you've got on one side markets and advisors, the other side all the way through to the molecular biologist. And you show the parallel communication flow, information flow, from farmers to agronomists and breeders, from agronomists and breeders back to farmers. That parallel flow is absolutely essential to make this all work, where all the scales get linked. And so more genes or more agronomists? Well, obviously, we do need both, but with appropriate balance between them in research investment in adaptation, and in adoption. Are we there today? Two quick charts. This one from Chris Boomsma from Purdue just summarizes investment in predominantly basic research versus applied research. The basic are the solid lines at the top. Applied research are those down at the bottom. Pretty clear story there. And then this is the one that is perhaps most alarming to me, and this is the number of PhD graduates in agronomy and crop sciences, plant breeding, and genetics. Now project that. When do we hit zero? That's a scary one. And at this point, I have to do a favor for Akeem. He asked me to make this statement to a subset in the room. All right? He says, please tell those young people in the audience to leave their fine molecular biology labs and get the heck back into agronomy. Thank you.
So, that didn't get your juices.
That's a scary thing to say with a mixture of group of people we have in this audience.
We have 5 minutes for questions. Yes, way in the back, please.
Yes, the question is, how do we reverse this trend away from applied agronomy and people that are involved in what's actually happening in the field? And of course, it is about funding, isn't it? The need for innovation is there, the ideas are there, but the funding has been redirected. And how do we drive it back into where it's a more balanced approach? I guess from a research standpoint, I'd like to think that some of the changes that we've seen in NEFA and in the funding mechanisms there, will that help? I think it has the potential to help in looking at systems and identifying, using old terminology, technology transfer. That's probably not a good term, but adoption. I think that kind of thing is very promising. Some of those structural changes, but it's not going to be easy. The industry, of course, is part of this player, and some of that training. I think there's great opportunity for expansion of internship programs, and we need to pursue those. We're talking internally about maybe launching some efforts in that way. But a lot of it's going to deal with funding, and a lot of the systems-related stuff really perhaps best comes out of the public sector. And so I'm hoping we can make some progress in increasing support at the government level.
Just a follow up, because this is a Green Revolution themed symposia and meeting, at the beginning of Green Revolution, what number, Tom? Two? But the one we call the Green Revolution, there was a much better appreciation of the need for the balance between agronomic field integration research as well as genetics. And one of the reasons was there was a much greater broad spectrum appreciation that there was an immediate challenge of meeting food security. That necessity is the mother of invention and getting things right. We've come off a period of 30 years where the perception in the public was there was too much food. It's hard to get it right. Hard for any public institution to be really concerned with getting it right when if you're wrong, there's no problem. So I think, in answer to your question, we start getting it right on the balance when there's a much broader perception that there is a race against time in food security going forward. Next question. Please, here. Yes.
I'm Anne Marie Throw, and I'm from NIPA, the National Program Leader in Plant Breeding and Genetics. Anybody else here from NIPA? I saw some of your lawyers. Paul is right. The new Competitive Grants Program, ACWI, is beginning to look at these kinds of system-wide questions, including agronomy, but we don't have an agronomy staff. It's been my priority for a long time, it just never happened. Could I take 30 seconds to tell people the most effective way to get comments to NIPA, if you'd like to do that, if you want to send it?
Thank you very much. Please, is that Johnny way back there?
That's Johnny.
Johnny Johnson, an officer in the UK. Very interesting today to me because in three separate presentations there has been mentioned the fact that better yields are associated with best farmers. And we see that in the UK, in our sugar yields at the moment, because of the current situation of imports, we're finding that better farmers are growing the high yields of sugar. I'm just wondering at the back of my mind that we're spending lots of money on improving genes in plants. What is the agronomic situation today, improving the genes in farmers? Are we surrendering?
Well, what do I say? Johnny Johnson thinks we should improve the genes in farmers. No, actually, Johnny makes a very valid point, and that to me, it's not maybe so much genetics, but it is about education, and that the process of creating a well-informed farmer, and I deliberately use that term farmer. I think it's time we forgot apologizing for calling people farmers or ranchers, because that forces us to recognize that they're business people that have a lot of competing interests to try to deal with, from family-related things to other things on the farm. But it's about management, it's about agronomy, it's about all those aspects of being a successful farmer. And that is about education and remembering that that is a critical part of this whole production agriculture system, is having a well-educated force out there actually doing the work. So.
Let's show our appreciation.